The Guardian.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Jason Phipps, sitting in for a rather poorly Alok Jha. We wish him well. On the show this week.
So he arrives in Paris in 71, so 11 years after he left. He finds that his heirs have declared him dead, divided up his estate, and he's lost his job in the Academy of Sciences. So he's clearly the most doomed and jinxed of them all.
Yes, the Venus transit is almost upon us. And to discover the epic story of the transit, we meet historian Andrea Wolf, the author of Chasing Venus, The Race to Measure the Heavens. And
now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene.
Rachel Carson shook the chemical industry to the core with the publication of her book Silent Spring in 1962 and is an icon to the conservation movement. We'll be joined by the Observer Science editor, Robin Mackay, to discuss her enormous contribution to science and the environment. Also,
it's what I call catch me if you can laws, because quite frankly, what happens with a corporation is that you have to litigate, you have to sue them through civil litigation, can take many years, and often those who are most adversely impacted have neither the wherewithal to do that or the finance.
Most of us are familiar with the legal concept of genocide, but what about ecocide? The Guardian's environment editor, Joan Vidal, speaks to barrister and campaigner Polly Higgins about her idea for an international law to defend Mother Earth. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The transit of Venus is shortly upon us, very briefly on the 6th of June here in the UK. But if you're listening to us in the US or further afield, you will see it on the 5th of June. And, weather permitting, it should be a treat for scientists and amateur astronomers alike. Well, this astronomical phenomena is the subject of the historian Andrea Wolf's book, Chasing Venus. The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample met up with Andrea and started out by asking her what exactly was the transit of Venus.
Well, a transit of Venus is basically when the planet Venus moves between Earth and Sun. And then you see Venus, which is normally one of the brightest objects in the night sky, you see Venus as a tiny black dot crossing the burning face of the Sun. And it takes about 6 hours, so not very long. It's one of the rarest astronomical events because they appear in pairs, 8 years apart, and then it takes more than a century for them to return. So this year, the heavens have something quite exciting for us in store because it's the last transit until 2117. So we will definitely be the last people living today to see it.
And that will be in the first week of June this year?
It will be in England on the 6th of June in the very, very early morning. So in London, for example, it will happen. You will see the last hour of the transit just, so you have to get up with sunrise, so just before 5 o'clock, and then it will finish at 6 o'clock. So it's for the early risers, really.
I'm going to come back and ask you about how people should best watch it and so on, what sort of technology or whatever they might want to use for that. But let's come to your book. Why was this event, the transit of Venus, such a big deal in the 18th century? Why did it become so important?
Well, in the 18th century, astronomers believed that the transit of Venus held the most, kind of answered the most important question of the age, which was the size of the solar system. So they thought they could use the transit of Venus like a natural astronomical instrument to measure the heavens, literally. And they believed that they could measure the distance between Sun and Earth, and then by extension, that would give them the size of the solar system.
So how does measuring the transit of Venus actually help you work out the size of the solar system?
Okay, I'm going to try to do this quite simply. The mathematicians here might complain. But basically what it is then if you see a transit of Venus in the northern hemisphere, you see it on a slightly different track crossing the disk of the Sun than if you are in the southern hemisphere. And these differences in the duration of the transit and between these tracks, the astronomers could then use, with the help of relatively simple trigonometry, to calculate the size. It's basically, it becomes a triangle. So you need to know the distance between the two observers on Earth. You work out the angle, and then you can work out the missing side of the triangle. So it was relatively easy, that bit. What was so difficult is that no observation on its own, because of this, would work. So you always had to pair them up. So you had to send astronomers to as many and as far apart places as possible. So you had to send someone way up, say, to the Arctic Circle, and then the counterpart to that would be someone in the South Pacific. So they had to work together to get this calculation going.
And how good were astronomers at the time at knowing even roughly how big the solar system was, or were they utterly in the dark? Did they have no idea, nothing to anchor their measurements onto?
No, they had an idea. So one thing they knew is they knew the relative distances of the solar system. So Kepler's third law in the 17th century had given them. So they knew exactly, for example, that Jupiter is 5 times further away from the sun as Earth. So they knew that. So it's almost like they had but they didn't know the distance between Earth and sun, which was the base unit of this. So it was like having a map of the universe without the scale. And they also knew. They had kind of like roughly calculated the distance. So they had, in the 17th century, thought it's about the distance between Earth and Sun is about 55 million miles. Today we know it's 93, just under 93 million miles. So not too bad, I would say, for the early 18th century.
And this was all Edmund Halley's idea, right? And what did he actually call for? Did he expect this to be a single nation project, or did he say the world needs to do this, essentially?
Yeah, I think if you look what he's doing, he's such a visionary. So in 1716, so this is almost 50 years before the transit happens, the first transit in 1761. In 1716, he sits down and he writes an essay, which he publishes in the Journal of the Royal Society in Latin, because that's the international language of science. And in this essay, he says, this is what we have to do. You know, in 1761, you all have to work together. And he very much emphasizes that all the different European nations should make use of their colonial possessions. So he says, you know, the English should send someone out to India, the Dutch to Jakarta. So he's kind of using the trading empires to have this idea. And he knows that this can only happen if everybody works together. That's why he writes it in Latin. And what is so visionary about is that he knows he's not going to see this because unless he would be 104, which he knew he's not going to be. So it's like a call of action for a future generation.
How ambitious was that of him to suggest that? I mean, were we talking about countries working together that historically or at that time just would not work together, about individuals who would not want to share information?
I mean, this, for me, because I'm not an astronomer, for me, this is the really exciting bit about this story, is that this is the first truly global international scientific collaboration. It lays the foundation of modern science. Everything what we understand today really comes from the transit decade. So it was incredibly ambitious what he suggested, because I mean, for the first transit in 1761, that's in the midst of the Seven Years' War. So you have all these nations, you know, at war. I mean, the whole of Europe is torn apart, including the colonial possessions. So there are war scenes everywhere. It's called the First Global War. So these astronomers going out into war zones, in pursuit of this elusive distance between sun and earth. So that's incredibly ambitious. And also they've never done this before. You know, this idea that you have, you know, the Russians, the Italians, the Germans, the Swedes, the English, the British, the Spanish, all working together, all sharing their results to come up with this one unit of measurement.
How are they going to do these measurements? And do they actually have to agree some standard way to do it? When you're talking about these people in wildly different countries, you don't even know who's going to be going. They wouldn't have had standardized measurements. I imagine their instruments weren't particularly good.
Well, I mean, so I find extraordinary, they're trying to get this measurement when there's no standard of measurements on Earth. You know, in France alone, there are 2,000 units of measurement. You know, a mile in Germany is completely different to a mile in Norway or a mile in England. And yes, that's one of the big problems, is that they, for example, they need to know their exact geographical location on Earth in order to calculate the distance between the two observers. And in order to do that, they need to calculate their longitude. Now, longitude you calculate by knowing how much you have traveled from your zero longitude. Now, the French took Paris as their zero longitude, the British took Greenwich. But the difference between the Greenwich Observatory and the Paris Observatory, they were still fighting and squabbling about that. So there is a lot. There are a lot of problems when it actually then comes to the calculations, because they can't quite agree on what is right and what is wrong.
When you go through your book, there are, and you read about the different characters who went off to monitor the transit of Venus. Some of them seem well and truly jinxed. They go through enormous hardships and then sometimes don't even get to see the transit. Can you just take us through some of these people who've had a hard time of it all?
Well, I think the most doomed of all was a French guy called Guillaume Le Gentil. And he was the first in the race. So he leaves in March 1760. He leaves France to go to Pondicherry, which was then in French hands in India. And everything goes wrong on his voyage. I mean, his boat gets attacked by the British. He gets into a hurricane. His health is ruined by dysentery. So it takes him 14 months to, you know, finally see the coast of India. It's like 2 weeks before the transit. So, it's all getting a bit tight here. And then he receives the devastating news that the British have just taken Pondicherry. So he can't go ashore. So he's like stuck on a rolling boat with a pendulum clock, so which is of no use at all. So he sees the transit, but scientifically it's of no use because he can't time it. So then he thinks, never mind, you know, there's the next transit in 8 years. So he hangs out in the region, you know, he doesn't go back to Paris. He, in 3 years later, travels from Mauritius to Manila, where he wants to observe the transit. So, you know, 3 years in advance, he's like totally organized, builds his observatory, sets up his instruments, cleans them, everything is fine. Then he gets a letter from the French Academy of Sciences saying like, what are you doing in Manila? You have to go to Pondicherry. So off he goes, packs his instruments, packs his bag. Few storms and months later, he arrives in Pondicherry a year in advance. Built his observatory. Weirdly, for a man who seems to attract misfortune wherever he goes, he builds it on a vault which has holds 6,000 pounds of gunpowder, clearly not minding his explosive basement, and then waits for the transit. And then on the day of the transit, he wakes up and there's this howling wind. So he's like, oh my God, what's going on? He looks out and they're just clouds. So he just sees the sun as this kind of dim light behind a curtain of clouds. And then a few hours after the transit, it's almost like as if the heavens are mocking him. The clouds disappear and the sun shines again. So, and then he kind of returns back. Story goes on.
He's a broken man, I presume.
He returns back.
It
takes him. So he arrives in Paris in 71. So 11 years after he left, he finds that his heirs have declared him dead, divided up his estate, and he's lost his job in the Academy of Sciences. So he's clearly the most doomed and jinxed of them all.
Can we talk a bit about the errors these guys had to deal with in their measurements? And this is where the geeky, but Cook wrote about, in his journal, he wrote about this dusky shade around the body of the planet. There's kind of the Venus looked fuzzy, and so much so that the timings he had differed from his ship's astronomer's timing by something like 40-odd seconds. And then there was this other issue called the black drop effect. I mean, what are those errors, and how do they sort them out? They sound seriously problematic.
Well, so after the first transit, all the results are kind of collected in the scientific societies, and they're looking at the results, and very quickly it becomes obvious that the observations were not as successful as they thought, because one of the big problems was that they had expected that Venus would just move quickly onto the sun. That's the time you take entry of Venus, and then kind of leaves it, exit of Venus. What actually happens is that Venus lingers at the edge of the sun, almost up to a minute, and becomes a bit pear-shaped almost. So it looks like if she's glued to the edge. It's like almost like she's reluctant to kind of start her path. And even, as you said, astronomers who were watching side by side couldn't quite determine what's the entry time now. But the entry and the exit times were the essential data they needed. So That made the calculations very imprecise. The other thing they observed was that the edge was the edge of Venus was trembling, and some of them saw like a halo-like ring around Venus. So these were all, you know, really distorting the results. And to be fair, for the second transit, I mean, they knew what they had to expect. So some of them took slightly better telescopes. So they took telescope with achromatic lenses, which kind of reduced the diffraction of the light slightly. So that made it a bit better. But
it gets less fuzzy.
Exactly. But they had the same problem. And if you look at photographs of the 2004 transit, you can still see the halo-like light. You can see the black drop effect. So that's a problem which didn't go away for them. And the result of the second transit calculation is much better than the first. But it's still, you know, they're still four. They have a range of results which is 4 million miles, which is not bad, I would say, but they were not totally happy with that because it's, you know, astronomy is a very precise science.
How long did it take them after the transit, then the last transit, to come up with an answer? How big is the solar system? And were they anywhere near close to what we would regard it today?
The second they get like a couple of results, they start calculating, but they know that's not going to be precise enough. So they start calculating in the summer after the transit. And but basically the final results, they have to wait for Cook to come back. So that's in 71. He comes back in July 1771. And then they calculate and they come up with a range which goes from 93 million miles to 97 million miles. Today's value is just under 93. So pretty, I mean, they're pretty close. I mean, compared to what, you know, what they thought in the 17th century. So I think the result is pretty impressive.
Coming to the transit this June, how should people watch it? Are there any sort of danger warnings, any safety lessons that people should be taking care
of? Yeah, it's basically the same as watching a solar eclipse. So you should not, definitely not just look in the sky, in the sun. You're going to hurt, you know, you're really, really going to like hurt your eyes. So you have to protect your eyes. So if you have sharp eyes, you can actually watch the transit with eclipse shades. You can see it, you know, you don't need a telescope for that. It obviously looks nicer if you look it through, if you watch it through a telescope. Telescopes, binoculars, all need to be equipped with the appropriate filters. There are also ways of projecting it, relatively easy of projecting it through a binocular onto a wall. And then you can obviously look at it directly. And there are lots and lots. If you just put into the web Transit of Venus, there are lots of websites which explain to you exactly how to do it. I think the most important thing in Britain is just to kind of just hope that we're going to have clear skies here, because that's going to be the biggest problem. Because we only have an hour here. And then if it's cloudy, you're like Le Gentil. You're going to look through a curtain of clouds.
Andrea, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
A huge thanks there to Andrea Wolf. And for great coverage of the transit, of course, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And also, if you go to the blog, we'll have links to some other sites and resources to help you witness this momentous event. Now, from astronomical to ecological, in 1962, the science writer Rachel Carson published a book that would arguably launch the environmental movement in the US and inspire environmental campaigners around the world. The book in question, of course, was The Silent Spring, and this year is the 50th anniversary of the book's publication. Alok Jha was joined by The Observer's science and technology editor, Robin Mackay, to discuss the work and the huge contribution made by Carson. At the time of the book's publication in the US, Rachel Carson was a controversial figure. So before we hear from Robin, this is a clip taken from a CBS documentary in 1963. It gives you a sense of Rachel Carson's steel in the face of huge criticism. And the criticism in question in this clip comes from a representative of the chemical industry at the time, the patriarchal Dr. Robert White Stevens.
Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment.
Rachel Carson was a marine biologist who also was an extremely gifted writer. She worked for the US Wildlife and Fisheries Department. I think it's the right department. And she was rose to be head of publications for them. But she also wrote a series of books, including The Sea Around Us, which won a US National Book Award. Really gifted writer. She left just after the war to pursue a career in writing, purely from the, you know, without any government backing, as it were. And at that time, it was becoming concerned through our scientific contacts with the amount of artificial pesticides that were being dumped on the American countryside. And a lot of these chemicals were powerful, very powerful toxins developed during the Second World War as potential chemical weapons. They were being used in the American countryside to spray vast areas of natural land, vast areas of farmland, gardens, suburbs, people in them would be aerial sprayed with these things. And what began to be kind of as a few kind of odd cases began to multiply. Birds found in the dozens, hundreds, thousands in cases spread all over the countryside. Insect life wiped out. And further up the food chain, things like otters and bears and other animals being wiped out. And then, of course, people were beginning to go down ill with the various toxins that they were being sprayed with, or possibly were eating through the food chain, because it was that, as it was going into the stuff that people were eating. And so she decided to write a book that would expose this. Interestingly enough, that she thought she would call it Man Against Nature at first. And her agent went, no, I didn't like it, and said, well, look, this chapter on the birds dying out, Silent Spring, I think you should call it that. And it was an inspired choice because it just became so resonant of the problem and sticks with us 50 years later.
50 years later, we're very aware of the potential problems of pesticides and what they're doing to the world. People have pesticide fear to some extent. But back then, in 1962... this was the first time anyone had so brazenly said this.
Yes.
So when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, tell us what the reaction was from these big companies who had basically won the war for the US and were doing whatever they wanted.
Yes, I mean, this was at a time when America was pretty right-wing, and there were, you know, an industry had saved America in many ways. And there was this person turning around, there's this woman, and this was part of her crime. She was a woman turning around and saying, you've not only not done your homework about the consequences, you willfully withheld information. And if you read the book today, it is actually quite a difficult book to read because it's an onslaught. It's case after case after case after case. She's a beautiful writer, but it was there as an onslaught because she wasn't just there trying to put right what was the problem of pesticide abuse. It was an onslaught against the paternalism of American science and American industry. And American industry was deeply pissed off, and it tried to sue her. It tried to sue the New Yorker, who originally serialized her book, and it tried to sue her publisher. When that didn't work, they set up a slush fund of $250,000, a heck of a lot of money then, and the aim was just to rubbish her.
Badly behaved scientists, these were.
The scientists, I mean, we've got to be very fair to the scientists. So many of them tried to help her in the background and gave her cases. So I think this, you know, science comes out of it slightly evenly. Industry comes out of it terribly.
Now, you can understand that from the point of view that they didn't want their bottom line sort of affected and their name besmirched. People say that Silent Spring was the start of the green movement, revolution. Is that true?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, Doris Lessing says it. Even Friends of the Earth say it. Greenpeace say it. Environment Protection Agency accepts that its birth was in, you know, in the after wake of Silent Spring. Yeah, I think it was the first time that ecological concerns were raised in a very powerful manner. And you've got to understand her writing was very strong for all the repetitive nature of Silent Spring, and her images are very powerful. So it stuck.
So you said just before that it's a catalogue of horror stories about the effects of pesticides and other chemicals on wildlife and on nature. Is it a good read, nonetheless?
It is a good read, yes. It is the formative book of the second half of the 20th century. And it is a good read, but you mustn't go in thinking it will just slip by you.
It'll be jolly.
Yes, it's a bit more like On the Road, perhaps.
Right. So what was the impact? I mean, we 50 years later, I said we have the environment movement, but what happened in that decade as a result of this clarion call from her?
In the immediate decade that followed, in the 60s, well, President Kennedy was interested in the book and was asked at one of his press briefings, had he read it? And he said yes. And he set up an inquiry. Kennedy was assassinated. By that time, the inquiry came out. Rachel Carson was dying. And it completely vindicated her. And in the wake of that, it set up the Environment Protection Agency was set up, as I said. But also, they decided that DDT would be banned, the most powerful of these chemicals, and several others. It took two other further presidents and 10 years for that to happen. And it took even longer in this country.
DDT is one of the most famous banned pesticides. Mm. In some ways, you could say it was a success for Rachel Carson's movement. She died in 1964.
That's correct. Which,
2 years after the book was published. So she didn't see it happening. But her legacy lives on in that. Now, she's not got a completely clean slate when it comes to sort of in modern terms. I mean, the DDT was banned, but then many critics of hers argue that because of the fact that DDT was banned, the mosquitoes weren't controlled. In places like Africa, you couldn't use this pesticide to actually kill mosquitoes, and therefore malaria ran rampant, and malaria kills millions every year. So,
well, I mean, you've got to take these claims with a pinch of salt. For one thing, the DDT was already, insects were beginning to build up resistance to it. And one of the reasons for taking it out of circulation is, in fact, it was becoming less and less effective. And two, majority of people that make these claims on websites all tend to be funded by the same people or rather roughly the same organisations that say that climate science is wrong and all sorts of other bits of nonsense.
Do you think it's all from there, though? I mean, is there not a part of you that thinks actually that there is a logic to that argument?
No, I don't think so. It was a deeply unpleasant chemical. It shouldn't be used in the environment. And if we wanted to deal with malaria by using pesticides, I'm sure we could come up with many better ones.
So why was she attacked in this way? Still, I mean, this is 50 years ago. DDT still doesn't exist anymore. We don't need to be attacking her. She's done a good thing. People still attack her.
If you want to have a go at the environment movement, attack the icon. That's the name of the game, and she's the icon, so attack it, even though the attack is unreasonable. And something sticks, something tarnishes her name, even though she doesn't deserve it.
Now, the modern environmental movement, which grew from these concerns in the 60s, is concerned. The modern one is concerned about climate change. It's a very different world. What relationship do the scientists now have with this sort of founding ideas?
Of Rachel Carson's?
Yeah.
I think scientists revere her, I would have thought. Yes, I mean, most people you would speak to said would give her the credit, first of all, for leading to the banning of DDT, also for a general awareness of ecological problems. But was in the long term she successful? Do we fully understand the shit we're in? No, we don't. In that sense, she has failed on a message. Ultimately, are still to get through.
Well, I was going to say, because we're still polluting the land and the seas.
It's much worse than it was then. Yep. The world 50 years ago.
We just know about it now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well put.
So what, can you outline the challenge for whoever Rachel Carson Mark II is? Who, what have they got to sort of do this time around, do you think, to make us sort of sit up and pay attention?
if I could answer that, I would do it, yes.
You would do it, Robin.
Whoever's got it has got a big task ahead of them.
I suppose the thing is, she talked about nature and the animals living on the land and stuff. We've been speaking to many scientists over the years on this podcast and other places about the sea. This is a place where pollutants are accumulating in huge amounts, and fish accumulating in fish, and then in the higher order animals. I mean, that's another entirely different challenge to deal with.
Well, I mean, in the article I wrote, I interviewed Callum Roberts, and he talked about, in fact, that's where it's all ended up. The DDT eventually gets washed into the streams and into the rivers and down into the sea.
Is it a persistent chemical? It will stay?
Yes, it is a persistent chemical. The trouble is, normally it would float to the bottom as a sort of sediment and lie there. But now we're trawling over seabeds, getting up every scallop, every prawn we can get. We keep churning it back up. So it's still, some of it's still lurking down there, along with a lot of course new pollutants we're putting in, brominated flame retardants and things like that. So, far from being better, it's much worse.
And just before we finish, it's probably worth pointing out, I'm sure you aren't, and certainly I'm not, this is not an anti-chemical rant, because there are those people that say chemicals are all terrible, chemicals are all bad, and that there should be no chemicals in the world, which is an idiotic thing to say. What is the logical, most sensible sort of way through this?
Use chemicals sensibly and use them with restraint. And it was the unrestrained use of chemicals, really, that Rachel Carson was getting at. And she was not anti-chemical as well. But people were just being absolutely silly. They wanted rid of a small, harmless gnat, which was annoying people. It wasn't even, it wasn't causing disease. And they killed just about every bit of life in Lake Clear in California, as an example. And that's just not how you use chemicals. And I think the chemical industry would now say, no, that's how we don't want our products used that way.
So, Robin, you're going to be talking about Rachel Carson's legacy at the Bristol Ideas Festival. Who's on the panel, and sort of what are their expertises?
Well, we've got Jonathan Porritt. He's going to be there for the environment movement. We've got Lucy Siegel from The Observer, who's our sort of a sustainable lifestyle guru. We've got Callum Roberts, oceanographer, and a couple of others.
Do you reckon you'll solve it by the end of the panel?
Yeah, I reckon we'll put all the world's problems down here. Yeah, that'll be all a piece of cake. Come along and see the world solved.
That's on 29th of May in Bristol. Thanks a lot, Robin.
Thank you.
If there is a new Rachel Carson, a stoic and dogged advocate for the environment, it could, arguably, be the barrister and environmental campaigner Polly Higgins. Polly has proposed the legal principle of ecocide as the fifth crime against humanity under international laws. The Guardian's environment editor, John Vidal, spoke to Polly to delve deeper into the legal principle of ecocide.
Ecocide is essentially environmental destruction, but I'm taking it further. I'm giving it a legal definition. The word itself has been around since the 1970s, and the definition that I propose into the United Nations is that ecocide is an international crime against peace, and that the definition for the actual word itself is mass, extensive damage, destruction to, or loss of ecosystems. Now, the wording is very deliberate because, in fact, what I'm doing is I'm widening the ambit. It's looking at any given territory, but it's also looking at all inhabitants who live in a given territory. So it's not just damage and destruction to the earth itself, but when you're looking at an ecosystem of a given territory, of course, that includes humans as well as non-humans.
Okay, Polly, can you give us some examples of what, in your new body of law, might be regarded as ecocide?
Well, in fact, there are two different types of ecocide. We have human-caused ecocide. So you can actually, look at a given area and say, as a result of human activity, we have mass damage and destruction here. The Athabasca tar sands in Canada is a very potent example of that. We were looking at an area the size of England and Wales that's proposed to be destroyed just to give us energy, and pulling up ancient arboreal wetlands and ancient forests there. Also, the Amazon. That's another good example of an ecocide that has been caused and continues to be caused by human activity, largely corporate ecocide, if you will. But there's a second type of ecocide, and that's naturally occurring ecocide. That's when we have a mass damage and destruction as a result of really catastrophic events, so tsunamis, floods, rising sea levels. Wherever you have mass ecosystem collapse that has happened as a result of some form of catastrophic event.
But your law would presumably be trying to arraign the human, the humans who are responsible. So, I mean, would it be corporations? Would it be individuals? Who would you be going after with this kind of law?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is. It's very much about holding individuals within the corporate world to account here. But it's particular types of individuals. It's those who are in a position of what's known in law of superior responsibility. So that's your chief executives, your directors, who are making the decisions that further down the chain can lead to mass damage and destruction. Although they may not be on the ground in the territory where it's actually taking place, they may well be in an office in a completely different continent. It's as a result of those decisions that are made at the top end that can have adverse impact to many, many millions of people, and not just people, but planet as well at the bottom end. But it goes further than that, because it's not just about imposing a legal duty of care on corporations. It's also about imposing a legal duty of care on governments and banks, because this is also about the decision making that's made at an international as well as a national level for policy, and also the financing of decision making of business and what it is that we're actually deciding that we see as acceptable business. And of course, this is a law that will close the door to business that is making profit out of mass damage and destruction.
But what level of proof would you need, and how would you actually measure the damage done, and what would be the difference, say, between abuse and ecocide? And surely there are many laws already which do prevent undue pollution and whatever. Why do we need this new body of law?
Well, one of the biggest problems we have is that existing environmental laws clearly aren't working, and we can see that because we have escalating mass damage and destruction playing out every day. And that's because most environmental laws that we deal with, the penalty is a fine. So it's what I call catch me if you can laws, because quite frankly, what happens with a corporation is that you have to litigate, you have to sue them through civil litigation, can take many years, and often those who are most adversely impacted have neither the wherewithal to do that or the financial ability to do it. And even if it is, once litigation is concluded, and that can take sometimes decades, often the amount paid out is too little and too late. What a crime of ecocide does is actually it closes the door beforehand. It's a think before you act piece of legislation, because instead of finding a company, what you're doing is you're imposing responsibility on human beings. And that's an absolute powerful direct disincentive. If you think as a result of your decision making in the boardroom, you could end up in a court of law and ultimately looking at imprisonment and sanctions of that sort.
If I can just come in, I mean, for example, you had the huge the Deepwater Gulf of Mexico spillage last year. I mean, surely BP, you know, didn't want to have to pay out $24 billion or whatever. I mean, surely that was enough to know that it shouldn't have been doing these things. I mean, why would a crime of ecocide make it act any differently?
Well, in fact, that's a very good example there. We held a mock trial last year here in the UK in the Supreme Court, and one of the counts on the indictment was the ecocide of the BP Gulf oil spill. What we're looking at there, and in fact it came up in the evidence because we used the real evidence that had been used and had been examined in America as well, is the fact that they had an environmental impact assessment that had been done not just for the Deepwater Horizon drilling platform, but also for 500 in the area. And that environmental impact assessment actually stated very clearly three times in it that they anticipated there would never ever be an accident, so therefore there was no need to do anything to prevent an accident happening. Now, and that was signed off and actually finance was raised for those platforms on the back of that. Now, we saw what happened with just one of them when something went very wrong there. But what you'll see with the crime of ecocide is that you'll have a very different decision-making process, because the decision-making process will not look to just ascertaining the risk of whether or not something will go wrong, but will actually look to the consequences of when it does go wrong. And when you look to the consequences, what you find is investment in such activities suddenly becomes far more stringent. And you'll have banks saying that there's not just a risk, but when it does, the consequences are so enormous that we don't want to go there because actually we could be investing in something that could give rise to an ecocide. What you'll find is also the company will make different decisions. It will be far more difficult to raise investment for that kind of activity, whereas it would be far easier to raise investment for, say, renewable energy.
What kind of opposition or support are you getting on an international level at the moment?
The amazing thing is that there's huge engagement around this, and there are 10 countries that already have a law of ecocide in place. And what we're seeing is one of those countries, Kyrgyzstan, has a prosecution at the moment playing out against a corporation, a coal operation in Kyrgyzstan. So this is a law that's not new in a way. All I'm doing is saying that we need this at an international level to actually create a level playing field. But there's more than that. We're getting an awful lot of engagement around this because it has a secondary level to it, which is about imposing a legal duty of care on nations to give assistance to each other for naturally occurring ecocide. And this is very important within the context of climate negotiations, because at the moment we've got the likes of the Maldives standing there saying, help us, we're going to go underwater within 7 to 15 years. And all countries are turning away saying, you know, we can't help you here. And in fact, we have 54 small island states that are looking at rising sea levels. So that's an awful lot of ecocide playing out. And the dialogue just hasn't even started.
You've got countries like Ecuador, which have put ecocide or the equivalent of law of Mother Earth, Bolivia. Many Latin American countries are thinking of going down this route. Taken to its extreme, I mean, that would mean corporations not being allowed to mine, not being allowed to cut anything down at all. Surely this would be a great constraint against industry or development. Is that not?
This is actually about, in fact, what it does is it forces mining companies to find innovation in a different direction, or it forces them to actually find ways of mining that are not going to cause mass damage and destruction. So if you like, rather than the butchery that we see at the moment, it's about going in and doing the keyhole surgery. So it's about finding the ways that you can, because obviously the extractive industry is not going to stop, but it's how we undertake extractive industry without causing mass damage and destruction. At the moment, we're just not having any assistance in prioritising looking at how that can be done. So the existing systems are very, very destructive.
Many thanks to Polly Higgins, and Polly is just one of the many speakers at this year's How the Lights Get In Festival in Hay on Wye, which runs from May 31st to June 10th. For more information on that, just go to howthelightsgetin.org, and Polly's website is pollyhiggins.com. Well, that's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. By next week, Alakja's immune system will have regained control. I'm positive of that. We wish him well. You can keep up to speed with breaking news anytime, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Jason Phipps, and Science Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.